Welcome to another Sandler Sales Podcast. My name is Paul Lanigan and my guest today is Rich Chiarello, author of Selling Technology the Sandler Way. And as someone who has sold for the likes of IBM, Siebel Systems, along with running CA's global sales organization, Rich has unparalleled insight into what's required to be successful in today's selling environment. Rich now runs a highly successful sales and sales management consulting practice based out of New York. Rich, you're very welcome to the show. Before I get into some of the nuggets that are in your book, I had some background questions for you. So maybe you could start by telling me a little bit about where you're from, how you ended up in sales, who you worked with in sales, and then talk to me a little bit about that moment the penny dropped for you when you realized that there was something different about this game of sales.
Well, I grew up in New York City and, worked myself through college, et cetera, and was fortunate enough to have an opportunity to interview at IBM. They said, we have two positions that are in sales. One is a tech pre-support and one is a salesperson. We're not hiring any salespeople, but we are hiring tech support people. Rich, what would you like to do? And that was okay. My first opportunity to see whether I was in sales or not. So I was, I always wanted to be a tech pre-salesperson, of course. So I got into that role, and after doing pretty well for a year and a half, I had a manager sit me down, Paul, and just say, listen, Rich, you can be a pretty good tech support guy for most of your career. You probably could be a very good sales guy. You know, we now have opening for sales. What do you think? And basically, as soon as the door opened up, is how I got into it. IBM at the time was a great company. I don't think there's any other companies today that will take a kid out of college in 2 years on their dime, training you in business, sales, technology, et cetera. That gave me a great platform for that. And then right about that time, the software industry took off. And so I saw a lot of my peers being taken away by some great companies into a great industry that was booming, and in 1 year made what I had made, in 9 years at IBM. And so that's how I kind of bridged the gap into software, like many other people, I'm sure, who'll be listening to this.
Okay. And at some stage, I'm guessing along that road, the penny dropped for you that your approach to sales wasn't giving you the results that you would have hoped for. Talk to me about that.
Sure. Well, I would say it was in the first software company I went to, a company called Cullinan Software. It was the first software company listed on New York Stock Exchange out of Boston. And they had some really, really great salespeople there from all over the industry that they had recruited. I remember going through a forecast meeting once with my manager there, a guy named Jim Williams, and he listened to us talk about all the reasons why we thought deals would close. And he just stopped and looked at us and said, Rich, all of you guys, you're basically telling me all the reasons why you need the deal to close. None of you are telling me why the customer needs to buy and why they need to buy now. That's what we need to go back and find out. And I'd say that was sort of an aha moment for me in my career, that it really dawned on me that in the technology space, and maybe it's the same in other industries too, but certainly in our space, we focused so much on a technical fit and all the reasons why we thought they needed to buy from us without ever really getting into the mindset of the customer. And as we know in Sandler now, today is personal pain. But what are there going to be the real trigger events to make a customer stand up to their boss, ask for their money, and buy from you? And I'd say that, to me, really turned around my whole mindset, their approach to sales.
And what do you think that is? Why do you think that the natural instinct is to focus on the product, the solution, rather than on the prospect?
Well, I think it's in technology space, it's a conditioned reflex. To this day, when I work with a client, their onboarding process is hire someone who knows a lot about the technology, train them for 2 weeks solid on products, features, its comparisons and competitors. And then they tell them, now get on the phone and don't talk technical, have a conversation. So I think the industry itself focuses so much on training people on product features and capabilities. So somewhere down the sales cycle, you can be a credible partner to the prospect. That is very, very hard at the beginning of the sales cycle to step back from that and have a conversation that starts out with, why would this person even care to talk to me? And why, if I was this person, as if they were my mother or my father, why would I ask my mother or my father to buy from me, given this person's needs? And so I think the industry itself lends itself towards being very feature focused.
Okay. And I'm just wondering, because most senior managers in these organizations understand it, understand that it's about the customer, but yet they continue to drive all marketing efforts in a very product-centric way. And I'm just wondering, have you any insights on why that is, that there's this disconnect?
Well, look, you know, you could look at any one company and probably come up with a different reason. Having done this now for 30 years, what I have seen is, especially in smaller companies, pre-IPO, who's at the top? And usually it's the founder, and the founder usually is someone who is brilliant enough to create either the market space or the product. And so what stems from them is the evangelist technology mindset that says, I have this great feature, I have this great idea, I'm an inventor, I'm bringing it to market. And what they, right, that transcends down to everyone else in the organization is a feature orientation that's very hard to break. Mm. But later on, when the company gets to a more mature status, usually that CEO has brought in someone who's a professional operative from the outside.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've often seen that with founders, is that because they are the founders, they're the ones who often came up with the original idea, is that they're able to sell the story, where those who follow afterwards don't have that story and just then resort to the stopgap, the product, the solution. But listen, I want to get on to talk about your book, because there are some absolutely wonderful nuggets in this. It's Selling Technology the Sandler Way. And one of the things you talk a lot about in the book is, and I look at it here and I'm just reading from it, it says, in the same way the physician uses symptoms of high temperature, elevated blood pressure and coughing and so forth to understand what solution, if any, is needed for the patient, the successful salesperson performs diagnostics in the same, on the prospect prior to or investing any significant sales time. So we have a great analogy there for how to approach prospects, like the doctor approaches the patient. Why do you think that analogy is so strong and so useful for those of us in sales?
Well, you know, when you're creating a story, when you're telling a story, you try to find something that people can identify with. Who of us, either themselves or don't know of a person who had the wrong diagnosis given to themselves or a friend for a medical malady, and the alleged cure caused more harm than good, right? And so in sales, similar type of thing, where you can really be hurting the prospect and therefore your reputation in the industry, mm-hmm, by jumping too fast on what you think the problem really is, mm-hmm, giving them what you think is the medicine or the solution. Mm-hmm. If they go ahead and buy it from you and it doesn't solve their problem, you know, maybe you move on to another customer, but that person is in real serious trouble, because that person, he or she, probably had to go to their boss, guarantee results, ask for the money, and then is being asked, after all that's said and done, why do we still have the problem? Or in some cases, why is the problem even worse?
There was another reason, there was something else that struck me when I read that as well, why it spoke to me, was the whole notion that when you go to a doctor, if you've got a pain in your back, you're not interested in understanding what the doctor knows about the shoulders or the head or anything else. You're not looking for a presentation. You want the doctor to figure out what's wrong with your back and fix just that. Right. Fair?
Well, let me take that one step forward, Paul. If a doctor tells you everything he knows about your anatomy and starts using big words, he'll scare the pants off you, right? The really great doctors use their knowledge of the human body and medicine to ask you intelligent questions. So if you come in and present certain symptoms, the first thing they may ask you is, have you been out of the country recently? Now, they ask you that question because their knowledge says, based upon what you've told them, they want to rule out certain maladies, and so they know what questions to ask. Based upon that answer, you know, they may ask you to put your foot on the table, let me feel if your ankle is swollen. And then based upon that, they may ask for some medical or blood work. It's their ability to hold back on the knowledge and know what questions to ask, given upon answers, that makes them be so effective.
I think that's hugely important, that they have the product knowledge. They need the knowledge, but they're not telling you what they know, but they're using that knowledge to ask the right questions and tell the right stories.
Correct.
Would that, yeah, fair summation. There was something else you said in your book as well, which jumped off the pages. It says, our current customer, this was an example you were giving where a sales rep was getting blocked, was coming back to his manager saying, hey, listen, that particular prospect told me that I'm not allowed to talk to anybody else in the organization, that that he or she is my contact, and that's it. And you were the manager where you said that you wanted to look at, or what you said to them was, let me actually have it here because I have it in the book. So what you said was, our current customer contact for our database products has told me not to reach out to any of these functional buyers. Now, our clients were Fortune 500 manufacturing companies. So one day I mapped out on a whiteboard for the latest account executive who gave me this excuse. At least 50 other software companies with similar solution to ours who were in the process of calling our customer without getting permission from your guy's contact. And that really jumped off the pages for me because it's so true. When you get stuck in that rut of saying, I'm only allowed to speak to this individual, you're so vulnerable because your competitors are talking to the functional heads. And I think that's really, particularly in technology nowadays, where maybe in the past that it was the head of IT was the contact, but now with software as a service, it could be the head of logistics, the head of purchasing, could be the head of sales, marketing, etc. In fact, it's probably many of those. And if you don't have those relationships, if you're not talking to everybody, you are really, really vulnerable. And I wondered if you had any advice for viewers on when they get stuck in that situation where somebody says to them, hey, listen, look, just send it to me. I'll take care of it internally. How do they deal with that?
Well, first thing is if this is a customer versus a prospect, if you've got a global account and this is your one big account, you have to be careful about taking the person who's going to make all your buying decisions and completely alienate them. So you can't just blindly go around the person. In that case, you know, using what we know in Sandler is you sympathize with the guy's feeling. Listen, I get it. You're afraid if I go around you, your boss is going to say, you know, why is this sales guy doing this? I count on, you know, you to keep this under control and in light. But here's the thing. By you and I not, you know, spreading out this message to the other departments, all of our competitors that neither you or I want to see to get into this account are going to be in there telling their messages, and it's all going to be unfiltered. Wouldn't it be wiser for us to control that thought process by you and I going together? That's how you approach it, you know, if they're an existing customer, that you have to maintain that relationship. But in the case of a prospect, it's almost comical. In the case of a prospect, as one manager once told me in one of my, at IBM, Rich, they're already not buying from you. They can't not buy from you any less than they're doing already. What are you afraid of?
True. So you have nothing to lose if it's a prospect, and if it is a customer, then get them on site, appeal to their sense of fairness, but also that it's actually in their best interest. Fair?
Right.
Okay, interesting. Something else in the book, and that which I again really spoke to me, was this example you gave where people, particularly when they're prospecting, often come up against that barrier where there are being, you know, I don't need, whatever it is you're selling, I don't need it. And that's quite common, I guess, obstacle or stall to come up against. But what you did with it, which I really liked, was you flipped it over and you said, you know, it's no less ludicrous for a seller to approach that prospect with the mindset is that you know, I have what you need. Today's your lucky day. Just talk to me a little bit more about mindset and the mindset that's required to be a productive seller and a productive prospector.
Well, sometimes it's referred to sort of like the belief gap. I mean, most salespeople today, they haven't been through our training program. By the time they actually get a prospect to pick up the phone and have a conversation, they're like, listen, I don't even know what this person does for a living, but at least they're a live person. And I start out my whole sales pitch with, you know, you're the last person in your zip code who doesn't own my product. What's wrong with you? You know, that you haven't bought from me is such a big mistake that I'm here to remedy. You have no idea You're talking to the right person, whether they need your product or not, but you go into that, you know, you must need what I have mode. And since prospects get that from sales guys all day long, their initial human response is the 180 degree opposite, which is, I don't even know what you're selling. You could be calling me to tell me that my car, you know, is on fire in the parking lot. As soon as I pick up the phone, I say, sorry, I don't need you. And so you got to reverse both of those. And the first thing we start out in our seminars, and we teach this, is start off with a whole tone that says, not sure if I even should be talking to you. And if you are the right person, there's no guarantee that you need anything that I'm selling. I'm willing to admit that. If you, Mr. Prospect, are willing to admit that you don't know yet whether you need what I'm selling, so why don't we just put down the facade, talk for 3 minutes, and if it's not a match, I'll move on and you'll move on.
There's such an honesty in that. It's hard to know what to do with it. I think if somebody, your approach that way, it's so honest. It just doesn't seem to fit that sales stereotype, and therefore, it just works. It blows away any of the defensiveness.
Right. Well, it's the classic pattern interrupt. It's being different in a good way.
Yeah. Good. I want to talk to you a little bit about this thing you call the post-sell. And where I jump again, where I saw it first in the book was you describe it as post-selling the appointment. So the context for this, I guess, is you're on the phone trying to get an appointment with a prospect. And at this stage, you have a date in their diary. But what struck me then was what you said, and I'm going to read this just verbatim because I want you to talk about this and why you felt it was so important to put it in there. He said, you know, Bill, sometimes when I speak with people such as yourself, I find that they want this next step to occur, but then after we hang up, other priorities pop up and sometimes these meetings get postponed or cancelled. Can you see that happening here? Just tell me, what are you trying to get at with that? What are you trying to achieve?
Well, you know, in every sales step, there is the, you know, what's the biggest fear at this point in the game, right? Early on in the sales cycle, when you're trying to get an appointment, the person could be saying, sure, I'll say, call me just to get rid of me. Or the person can mean well and really would like to talk to me, except if something more important pops up in his mind between now and then, they'll cancel the call. What Sam has really taught me midway through my career was you can get almost any type of behavioral change you want out of a prospect if you're willing to ask them. And so once I ask somebody who's just made the appointment, do you see any reason why this won't occur? One of two things will happen. They'll think hard and say, well, gee, you know, why talk on Thursday? I know my boss Lee's on vacation that day. He may call me into his office. Rich, let's move the call to Friday. That'll be safer. So in that case, by having them think through it, we actually made sure that this call did occur. But let's say that that didn't happen. They thought about it and said, no, you know, you call me that time and I'll be it. By getting the prospect to tell you that they will do something, it doesn't make it impossible for them to cancel, but it makes it that much harder as a human being when you say you're going to do something or not do something. You know, maybe they'll cancel somebody else's meeting, but not mine. And that's proven to work over the years that we've been doing that. Just ask the prospect, you know, for the help and get them to agree to do something. And more times than not, that works.
So what you're doing is you're just minimizing the risk, lowering the possibility that occurs. There's no guarantees. You really are. You're playing the percentages game, it sounds to me like. And as you said that, I was wondering how much of the rest of what you do in sales is playing the percentage game.
All you can do in sales is increase the odds, right? So if you look at one of the chapters in the book, it talks about the simple math of sales, right? So every customer I go into work with can tell me when they have engaged with a qualified prospect, you know, what percent they close. And usually, you know, that's greater than 50%. The biggest challenge they all have is how much time it takes, how hard it is to find a qualified prospect. So you want to increase the odds. The biggest thing you can do is increase the odds that something that gets that the number of people you talk to will generate more qualified prospects. It's the same thing here. Nothing is 100% guaranteed, or you know, anyone who tells you anything in sales is guaranteed is not telling you the truth. But you'll be shocked how much you can get a prospect to change their behavior just by asking them certain questions.
Well, speaking then of prospect behavior, something else you said resonated with me. You said that if you were to stop calling prospects in your pipeline, how many of them would call you back? And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Is that realistic? Because I know there's going to be a lot of people who are watching this or listening to this in a podcast. They're going to be going, look, Paul, look, Rich, that's just not realistic. You stop calling, they're not calling you back. So were you just trying to provoke something there? Or do you realistically think that if you set the sale up in a particular way, they're going to come chasing you rather than the other way around?
No, it's the reality. And there's two questions that we ask in the book. When we go into a room full of salespeople to start a training session, the first thing I ask them is that first question. Think of all the deals in your pipeline, including the ones you're forecasting. And if you stop calling them today, how many would call you back? And even of the deals they're forecasting, I never get an audience to say even 30% would call back.
Wow.
Then the second question I ask, of all the deals in your pipeline and forecast, how many of those is there a buyer who needs to buy from you more than you need to sell to them? And then all the hands go down.
And when you dig deep on that, do you find differences? Or let me ask you another way. What are the differences between those prospects who would call back? What's different about their situation than those who wouldn't call back?
Well, clearly the difference is that the ones that will call back, the sales reps have done a good job of qualifying hard, as opposed to accepting, asking a few surface questions, getting someone to say, yeah, I might be interested, and then they start a long sales cycle where there's no emotional involvement, there's no personal pain or that gets solved, there's no personal motivation, there's no stake in it for the prospect, and by and large, the sales guy is doing all the work.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I knew a sales manager once, and when he would take a junior rep with him on a call, he would always set it as an objective that the rep had to get the prospect to follow up with him, not the other way around. So they were going to have a meeting, and the meeting had to be so strong and so prospect focused that when the rep got back to his office, that the prospect had followed up with the notes of the meeting, not the other way around. I know that's a crazy thought to some people, because they see it as their job to do all the donkey work, but I think sometimes they forget that the prospect's the one with the problem and they're the ones with the solution.
Right. Well, look, if you were to net it all out, it doesn't matter what solution you sell, but if you can have a conversation with somebody who admits, this is my number one area to fix, my boss has asked me to fix it this year, and if I don't fix it, something bad will happen to me. I could either lose my job or not get a raise. If I do fix it, something good will happen to me. I could get promoted. If you get that type of need and someone to articulate that to you, and then you ask them, is this something you'd like to explore with me fixing? They usually won't let you disappear. Now, you as a salesperson can go find another person to go sell your solution to. So you actually don't need that prospect as much as that prospect needs you. And that's that concept of who needs this transaction to happen more, you or the prospect. Most of the time, the reason forecasts slip and don't happen is the sales guy, 90%, needs it 90 times more than the prospect needs the deal to occur in that certain time frame.
I wonder what you think of the thought as well, that sometimes people are just afraid to disqualify, that they're afraid to come back to their manager and say, I met with that prospect, I spoke to that prospect, and I just don't feel they're a good fit. And then the manager goes crazy and says, no, you follow up, you send them a proposal, rather than, and I just wonder, is that something you've come across?
Well, yes. Usually, sometimes, unfortunately, that starts if marketing throws too wide of a net and says, for example, let's say you were selling CRM. Well, anyone who's a salesperson needs to buy our product. Well, that's not true. I don't care what CRM you're selling. But some are better prospects than others. And some, even if they need it, don't have the decision power or the money to buy it. And so making people qualify too quickly and engage in a process is the death knell to technology sales. You're much far better off trying to answer the question, which is, you know, why would someone need to buy it? Why would they need to buy it now? In one of my recent posts, I told people who, you just missed your forecast, go back to your prospects and just ask them the very simple question. Okay, the deal didn't happen last quarter. I'm creating my forecast for this quarter. If you were me, would you forecast the deal? See what they say. They say yes. Ask them all the same questions your manager will ask you in your QBR. Why do you think it'll happen this quarter? Yeah. See what they say. Why wouldn't it slip again? See what they say. Let me ask you one more question before I let you go. The final question is, so if you don't buy it this quarter, what's the worst that happens to you in the company? The same questions you're going to be asked in a QBR by your manager, just go back and ask this prospect you've built a relationship for and get the answers. Don't be afraid to ask those questions.
But it's interesting. Again, I just want to jump onto a management track for a moment, because you said you're going to be asked these questions in a QBR. Well, that's quarterly. Really, should a manager be waiting that long before they're asking these questions of a rep? Or should they be asking these kind of questions after every single call?
Be asking them on a regular basis, right? As the deal is, as they're investing time and effort into this, right? Especially if you have a long sales cycle, right? You know, if you have a 30-day sales cycle, kind of hard to dig into each of these. But in the technology space, there are many folks that sell solutions that have 6 to 9 month sales cycles, and so it's a little bit of managing negligence if you let someone go 5 or 6 months into a 9 month sales cycle before you ask questions like, you know, why does this person need it? What happens to them if they get it? What happens if they don't, right? So.
Okay. Actually, do you know, I want to talk to you about a story in your book. It was, we were talking about the decision stage of the qualification process. And it really, really tickled me because, I say it tickled me, it disturbed me because it really resonated. And I want to read it out verbatim for viewers. And this is what you said. You said, I had a local CIO tell me, and I guess when you say local, this was somebody in North America or in your particular patch. I had a local CIO tell me once that when he questioned the corporate CIO as to why he was first told it was a local decision and then later overruled, the corporate CIO explained, "We were hoping that you would select what we'd already were using in other divisions so that we wouldn't have to overrule your decision." That when I read that, I went, oh my Lord, this is, what this said to me is how complex, how political getting a decision is in an organization, that people play these games all the time internally, and that if you are not really, really savvy, you can get caught up in these. And I really just wanted to spend a little bit of time with you talking about the complexity of or navigating your way through the decision-making process. That we spend a lot of time talking about pain as important as it is. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on particularly in high-tech space where decisions can be quite complex and there's many different buyers in that. And then you have, you know, the budget is might be held in one region, but the users in another region. And just how complex is that? I mean, is your story typical? I guess that's my real question. Is it typical?
Well, it's not typical in smaller transactions. You know, in large transactions involving large deals on infrastructure, ERP systems, you can't have the goal is not to have everybody have their own email system, ERP system, right? It has to be a really, really good reason for that. And so the point we're out in the book is if you're selling things of that magnitude with 9 months to a year or longer sales cycle, even if the customer is telling you what they believe to be true, which is, I can make this decision, you as a salesperson have to ask yourself whether you think they're right. And you have to ask questions like, does any other division in your company use a different product than what headquarters uses? If the answer is no, what makes you think if we go through this exercise here, it'll be different? Because again, as I said in the book, many times they're just told, yes, go out, look at it. Yes, of course, it's your decision. But in the end, there's someone very close to the installed vendor who will put an end to it. and you've wasted a year.
You talk about RFPs in your book, and I wanted to get your take on RFPs. Are they a good thing? If so, have you any tips for people who respond to RFPs? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, there's the world of state and local federal government, which is all mostly RFP. So, you know, you have to separate the two. And so in that world, typically RFPs should not be a surprise. You have people who have worked for years doing business development, formulating the needs of the RFP. So when the RFP comes out, you're expecting it and, you know, you've been positioned, you know, well into it. In the private sector world, you know, RFPs usually, unless you've done the same thing, you know, there are many companies that run like quasi-government companies, telcos, et cetera, electric companies, where they still like to have a formal RFP process. Again, there, though, if you haven't been involved in creating the RFP needs, and you get one lopped on your desk as a surprise, many times in just reading through it, you could see which company had been there ahead of time formulating the needs. And sometimes it's very clear that you'd be at a disadvantage. In that case, you really have to make a tough decision on whether it's worth, you know, your time or effort.
Yeah, I think that's a tough one as well, because it's often a head and heart battle that you're kind of blind half blind, and you've got to work through that first.
Right, you know, and sometimes it's real clear, not only has someone else been there first, but who that other company is, and you basically were outsold, or they got to this person or whatever. And you can tell pretty much by going to the first bidders conference, you know, how this thing is going to go. But other times it's wide open, especially if you're the number one market leader, because one of the things that's changed today versus when you and I first got started is buyers use the internet, you know, to go through the first 60% of the sales cycle to figure out who the top companies are and who they want to, you know, talk to and compete with. So a lot of the whittling away goes by their own research.
Okay. Well, Rich, unfortunately, we're up on time. I wanted to say, though, before I let you go, what a fantastic read this is. And if you are in technology sales, I would definitely recommend. I'm going to put the details where you can get a copy in the description below. Before I let you go, Rich, I want to ask you, I'm a huge believer in reading and benefiting from other people's experiences. Who would you say, if you were to pick three influencers that you pay attention to, you like to read or watch their content on LinkedIn or YouTube, in the sales leadership area?
Well, there's so many fine people out there. You know, I'm sure I might leave some out. There are many influences, but, you know, the top three that I've seen to identify most with their posts and reads are Grant Cardone, Daniel Pink, and Dan Walshmit. You know, there's only so many ways you can sell, right? But the concept of not assuming that the person you talk to is the right person or needs from you, and being a conversationalist versus a hard-pressing salesperson, you know, I kind of identify with their posts more than others.
Okay, thanks for that. And if people want to get in contact with you, Rich, how can they do that?
The easiest thing to do is to send me an email. It's rich.chiarello, that's C-H-I-A-R-E-L-L-O. @sandler.com.
Rich, I want to thank you for your time. Your insights, truly valuable. Thanks again. Much appreciated.